From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today, we'll listen again to some of our favorite author interviews of 2009. Later in the program, you'll hear novelist Lisa See talk about her latest book, Shanghai Girls, journalist Steve Lopez discussing his bestseller, The Soloist, and former poet laureate Rita Dove talking about Beethoven, ballroom dancing, and more. First, Daniel Handler, best known for his hugely successful children's books written under the pen name Lemony Snicket. Those books are known collectively as A Series of Unfortunate Events. When I spoke with Daniel Handler in February, I asked him why he created the character of Lemony Snicket as the supposed author of his books.
Well, the Lemony Snicket name first came about as a prank long before I thought I was going to write anything for children, let alone write anything for children under a different name. It was a name that I would sign when I was writing long, mock, angry letters to the editors of tiny newspapers in the San Francisco Bay Area. This was my hobby when I was in my early 20s. I can really offer no excuses for that hobby, and I do not recommend it for young people who may be listening. You should do some other hobby, like stamp collecting.
How did you come up with the name? It's such a wonderfully colorful name.
It just popped into my head. I've been accused since of taking it from Jiminy Cricket, who I always found to be overly moralistic and irritating, and is probably one of my least favorite insects. But no, the name just popped into my head.
When you first started playing around with that character, Lemony Snicket, writing letters to small papers, did he resemble the character that people think of Lemony Snicket as because of the books?
I suppose so. He was unreliable. He was an hysteric. He was not to be trusted. And he showed a devoted interest in tiny things that most people are not interested in. Those qualities have carried me forward all my life.
My guest is Daniel Handler, the novelist. He writes literary novels under his own name and was the author, under the pen name Lemony Snicket, of the series of books for children called A Series of Unfortunate Events. Did you set out as a novelist to become famous for writing books for children, or did you see adults in your future when you started out?
Well, I certainly didn't set out to become famous at all. I merely was interested in writing stories, and I tried to tell them in an interesting way, and frankly, I'm grateful that anyone wants to read anything that I write. Taken children, adults, I would have taken animals. Had there been literary animals willing to read my books, I would have been thrilled.
Yes. But your first books were for adults, correct?
Yeah, I've been writing them kind of simultaneously. My first book came out for adults about 6 months before my first children's book.
I see. Tell us how you set about writing one of your books.
I read a bunch of obscure, gothic, spooky books about terrible things happening to people in days gone by. I make lists of the most interesting terrible things. I try to shape them into a story, and then I sit in my small room where I'm sitting right now, muttering and writing things down on pieces of paper and crossing them out.
And that you read gothic, spooky books regardless of whether you're writing for children or for adults?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I can't stop reading books in which terrible things are happening, so I figured I should work up some way to write that off.
Are you one of these writers who comes up with a master plan for a book with all the nooks and crannies of the plot, and then you basically flesh it out, or is it more of an improvisational process where you start on page one and then hope to end it on page whatever?
I'm a master planner, and then the plan goes horribly awry, and I have long arguments with myself in which I plead myself to follow the master plan and then inform myself that I'm not my own boss and that I don't have to follow the master plan if I don't want to. And that's why there's so few people who are willing to step into my office while I'm working.
Why do you think a series of unfortunate events, the Lemony Snicket books, why do you think they were such an enormous success?
I honestly have no idea. I used to have an explanation for why it was that I developed, but one time I was listening to the conservative commentator Bill O'Reilly be interviewed, and he gave more or less the same reason why he was so popular, and I decided that he couldn't possibly be right, and so therefore I wasn't right, and so I have no explanation at all.
And what was it he said?
He said that he was telling people what they wanted to hear, which every time I've heard him, he's not telling anything that I want to hear, and that alarmed me. So I decided that I wasn't going to say that I was telling people what they wanted to hear because there was no reason to conclude that.
Yeah, although I guess if all you're doing is telling a few million people what they want to hear, then that's probably good enough.
I suppose so. When I was a child, I liked to read books about terrible things happening, and I didn't know any other children who liked that. Now there seem to be a bunch of them, so I'm confused as to where they were when I was young, but I'm grateful that they're here now.
When you started out writing, when you were quite young, I guess, and you could have seen your actual literary career ahead of you, how do you think the young Daniel Handler would have felt about that?
Oh, I think I was insufferably arrogant enough when I was a child that that would be a curse to know that I would have had any degree of success. I was fairly certain I was going to fail, and I think that worked in my favor.
Fail as a writer? Meaning in what way? That you wouldn't sell any books or that the books wouldn't be any good?
That no one would be interested in them. I mean, it's hard to know whether they're good or not. I thought I could write well enough to entertain myself, but it is not a good way of making a living.
What was your involvement in, and what did you make of the movie based on a series of unfortunate events?
I wrote 9 drafts of the screenplay, and then I was fired.
Wow, 9 drafts.
But it's okay. In general, I just have a policy not to say anything mean about a movie that bought me a house. And I feel the same way, actually, about radio hosts. If you were to buy me a house, I would never say a mean word about you again. Other people would say, I don't know, that guy, that Jeffrey Callison, I don't like him. And I would say, he is a noble man, brave and true.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that, but I haven't quite managed to scrape together the money for the house, but I'll work on it.
Yes, I seem to read in the news that you're not the only one having that trouble.
Well, that's definitely true.
Maybe Sacramento's own Arnold Schwarzenegger can save that.
Well, we'll cross our fingers on that one. Getting back to the film, did you understand why you had to write all these drafts, or did the first one seem perfectly good to you?
I would say that after the third one, they all seemed just about alike. But I understood when I had to write them because films are incredibly expensive. And people are nervous about investing that much money, and so they want to have their nervousness assuaged by more drafts of a screenplay.
Yeah, but it's also true, I'm sure, that films are very different from books, which might be why sometimes people who are fans of books aren't so happy with the film that ends up, because it necessarily has to be different.
Oh yes, absolutely. I've never been someone who got very upset when an adaptation of a book goes awry, because I figure you have the book, you have the thing that you like, so it's just some other version of it. So it's kind of like hearing someone sing a song that you love. If they sing it badly, then you still have the song you love.
In addition to all your writing, you're also a musician, and you've written a symphony for children.
I've collaborated with a composer, Nathaniel Stuckey, on a piece for narrator and orchestra. So I haven't really written the music. I've written a story. It is called The Composer is Dead. And it was commissioned by the San Francisco Symphony a few years ago, and it's now coming out as a book. We've been performing it all over the place with various orchestras.
Is this meant to be a project to help raise the level of interest in classical music among children? Is that the point?
Well, I would like to raise the level of interest in classical music among everyone. Children don't have a monopoly on not being interested in classical music. Just about everybody isn't interested in classical music. And it was also written basically because I was annoyed by the story of Peter and the Wolf, and I thought it was time to have a new story so that no one had to hear that terrible story over and over again.
What's wrong with the story? I mean, it does seem like it's a gothic, spooky kind of story.
Well, it's true that a bird is eaten, but that's a kind of low level of chaos and terror as far as I'm concerned. And I always found Peter's grandfather to be overly moralistic and irritating and bossy.
Well, do you think people who are listening to this symphony, that they'll be able to tell that the guy behind Lemony Snicket wrote this?
Well, I think they'll probably be filled with a vague sense of dread that they may find familiar from reading books by Lemony Snicket, yes.
Yeah. Well, notwithstanding the shortcomings of the Peter and the Wolf story, the music that Prokofiev wrote is just so amazing and timeless and works for both children and adults that what's the music like in this symphony?
Well, I've been told very sternly by the composer, Nathaniel Stuckey, that I should stop wandering around saying that the music he writes is better than the music by Prokofiev, even though it is what I believe. He says that it's too embarrassing, and he is a huge fan of Prokofiev, and he won't take it. So I won't say that anymore. But I will say that I think Nathaniel Stuckey is an incredibly talented composer. He's written all sorts of works for all sorts of ensembles, and that I think this is a beautiful piece that introduces the orchestra to people who might not be familiar with it.
As a musician, you play the accordion.
Yes.
How did you get into that?
I had played piano and various keyboard instruments my whole life, and then when I went to college, I wanted to be in a band, and it was during a brief kind of window in American popular music history in which keyboards were not cool, and so I took up the accordion. And so I like to say that I'm the first person in history who took up the accordion basically in order to meet women.
What's it like to play the accordion?
Well, the nice thing about playing the accordion is that you're probably the best accordion player anybody knows. So I'm not very good, but no one knows any other accordion players. So I'm invited to play accordion in various musical situations that would never welcome me if I played the guitar or the saxophone at the level at which I play the accordion.
It's hard to imagine Lemony Snicket playing an accordion.
People have definitely imagined it a number of times.
I see. Daniel Handler, novelist. He writes literary novels under his own name and was author under the pen name Lemony Snicket of the series of books for children called A Series of Unfortunate Events. Daniel Handler, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, novelist Lisa See and her book Shanghai Girls. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We're listening again to some of our favorite author interviews this year. One of the most acclaimed novels of 2009 was Shanghai Girls by Lisa See. It's the story of two glamorous young Chinese women fleeing from war in their homeland and moving to California. When Lisa See joined us in June, I asked her how she got the idea.
Well, there were a couple of things. They're what were called beautiful girls in Shanghai in 1937. They were models for Shanghai advertising. And I've been collecting that advertising for about 15 years. And often I've looked at those images and thought, what was life like for those girls in real life? What would it have been like? And then in my family, we actually had a lot of arranged marriages. For example, my great uncle back in 1932 went back to China, took his sons, and, you know, a lot of dads would have said, here's a little money, go buy a souvenir. He said, oh, you know, as long as we're here, let's just get all you boys' wives. And that's what they did. And so these young women were sort of aged 15 to 25 in China. They had had servants. Once they came here, they became the servants. So these were my aunties. So part of it was, you know, these images of beautiful girls, and part of it came from my own family.
The cover of your book, Shanghai Girls, is striking. There are two very beautiful Shanghai girls. Where did this come from? Is this one of those
posters? This is actually one of the posters that I have in my collection.
I see. And the two young women are Pearl and Maid. Is that what you think they look like?
Absolutely. It's so amazing. I mean, they do look like that in my mind.
What kind of people were these beautiful girls?
Well, some of them in real life, some of them were actresses, some of them were professional models, some of them were actually prostitutes, you know, because prostitutes were beautiful in those days and in Shanghai. These two girls come from a pretty good family. They're in the kind of, I guess you could say they were sort of the Paris Hiltons of Shanghai. You know, they came from good families, but they wanted to be out there having fun and doing things and hanging out with artists and musicians and writers.
And we see that life at the beginning of the book. I'd love to hear you read from it, though, as the tone changes. It's about a quarter of the way through the book, and Pearl and May and their mother are trying to flee the war, and they're spending the night in a shack, and the man who's pushing their wheelbarrow sleeps outside, and then Japanese soldiers arrive.
Right. We hear the scuffling of their boots, their harsh, guttural voices, and the wheelbarrow pusher's cries for mercy. Whether on purpose or not, his suffering and death give us time to hide. But we're in a two-room shack. Where can we conceal ourselves? Mama tells us to take the planks from the sawhorses and lean them against the wall. Slide in behind, she orders. May and I look at each other. What's Mama thinking? Do it, she hisses. Do it now. Once May and I get behind the planks, Mama reaches in. She holds her bride price bag and our papers wrapped in silk. Take these. Mama. Shh. She grabs my hand and wraps it around the bag and package. We hear her scrape one of the sawhorses across the floor. The planks push up against my sister and me, forcing us to turn our faces to the side. That's how tight a space Mama has made. But we're hardly hidden. It will be only a matter of time before the soldiers find us. "Stay here," she whispers. "Don't come out, no matter what you hear." She grabs my wrist and shakes it. She switches to the "say yep" dialect, not wanting me to understand. "I mean it, Pearl. Stay here. Don't let your sister move from this place." We hear Mama leave the room and shut the door. Next to me, May takes shallow breaths. Her exhale falls on my face, warm and moist. My heart thumps in my chest. From the other room, we hear the door being kicked open, the stomp of boots, loud military voices, and soon enough, Mama pleading and bargaining with the soldiers. At one point, the door to this room swings open. Lantern light flickers in from the sides of our hiding place. Mama screams, sharp and shrill. The door shuts and the light goes away. "Mama," May mules. "You have to be quiet," I whisper.
That's Lisa C., the novelist, reading from her latest book, Shanghai Girls. What follows is a very difficult passage, and there are a lot of very difficult scenes from war in your book. How did you figure out what war looked like? Because these are very visual descriptions you give.
Mm-hmm. Well, I interviewed people who had survived in that time. There was one woman in particular who was orphaned and with the other children in her orphanage had to walk about 1,000 miles inland from Hong Kong inland into China. And she gave me so many details about what life was like on the road. One of the things that Pearl and May do is they make this concoction out of cold cream and cocoa powder to smear on their faces so they'll look more country, less like beautiful girls. And that was something that Monica told me, and, you know, she had remembered from that time when she was so young herself.
You explained to us how you got the idea for Pearl and May, these beautiful girls in Shanghai. How did you develop the idea of taking them through this hell on earth, the escaping the war, mm-hmm. and then coming to America?
Well, Shanghai, when the novel starts, is at this last final moment. It was the Paris of Asia, and things did start to go down from there. That point, you know, the Japanese invaded. This moves into World War II, then Civil War, and then Mao took over the country. And so this was this final moment. And so what I wanted to sort of show was, as May and Pearl are in this final moment, these beautiful girls, what happens when their world starts crumbling beneath them? And it crumbles in many ways. It's not just the war, but their father has gambled away all of their money and they've lost everything. And so now they're trying to, at least in the beginning, keep ahead of the Japanese, keep ahead and stay alive. And yet they also know they have to get to this ship that will bring them to America and to their new husbands.
When they come to America, they go as was the norm, I suppose, for people coming from China, to a place that many people in California, Northern California, are familiar with, either because their ancestors came through there or because they visited it because it's a park, Angel Island.
Mm-hmm. Many people know Ellis Island, of course. You know, 100 million Americans can trace their ancestry to relatives who passed through Ellis Island, but Angel Island was a very different kind of place. At Ellis Island, you would answer a standard 20 questions when you came through. You had a medical exam, and yes, it was humiliating at points. But at Angel Island, the whole purpose was to keep the Chinese out. And so instead of answering a standard 20 questions, people had to answer anywhere from between 200 and 1,000 standard questions. And these were very difficult questions designed to make people make mistakes so that they would be detained for weeks, months, sometimes years before they were deported back to China or committed suicide, or if they were very lucky, were finally allowed to land in San Francisco.
Pearl and May live in California after the war, and California has an uneasy history. In the past, with people from East Asia, Chinese were discriminated against by the government, mm-hmm. not just by individuals, for many decades. And of course, there were the internment camps, Japanese Americans taken from the homes in California and elsewhere. What was life like for Chinese in California after the Second World War?
Well, after the war, there was this period where it seemed like everything was going to change. When the U.S. entered World War II, they overturned the old Exclusion Act, so 1943, and China and the U.S. were allies. People thought that this was going to change everything. And in those years after the war, people could now all of a sudden, who'd come from China, could now become naturalized citizens. They could buy property. In 1948 in California, Chinese could finally buy property. They could marry whomever they wanted also in 1948. But just 1 year later, in 1949, is when Mao took over mainland China. And we had and still have this great fear of communism, and rightly so. But that sense that China had turned into this communist country, and then this was, you know, immediately followed by a Korean War, really instilled a lot of fear in the general population, but also in the government. So all of the gains that had been made sort of between 1943, when the U.S. entered the war, and to 1949, many of those were lost. And it was very hard. You know, this discrimination came back full force.
Let's talk a little bit about Shanghai. I don't know if you've been there, but in this book, in the 30s, Shanghai, as you said, was the Paris of Asia, a very glamorous city. Then for many decades, Shanghai, like the whole of China, became a grayer place. But now Shanghai seems to be a glamorous, booming city again.
Oh, it is. Absolutely. I was just there in April, and I don't think you could say it's now, once again, the Paris of Asia. You could say it's more like the New York of Asia, but actually, it might be most accurate to say that New York is now the Shanghai of the rest of the world. Shanghai is such a wealthy city, cosmopolitan city, trendy in many ways, diverse. It's just an amazing place to be and to see, because no, even now, as I'm describing it, I'm thinking I can't really get across what it's like right now.
Yeah. What are you working on next?
It's a sequel to Shanghai Girls.
So you're staying with Pearl and May?
Staying with Pearl and May and their daughter, Joy.
And was that the plan when you started the book?
It wasn't, but every single reader has gotten to the end and said, I want to know more. I need to know more. What's going to happen next?
Was that you when you were writing the book as well? Did you have that sense yourself when you were writing it?
Well, sometimes it is true that the characters aren't done with me. You know, so often writers say, I was done with those characters. But the other flip side is they weren't done with me. And yet I thought that this did come to an end. The end is a beginning. There is, but and it isn't all fully resolved. But isn't that what life is like? Life isn't always fully resolved. But I guess people, so either I'm a really bad writer, or
I don't think
I was doing something that was the exact right thing to do. And the fact that readers want to know what's going to happen next, I think is very exciting.
Have you actually started writing it?
I've done all of the research, but I haven't started writing. I have to finish the book tour first.
Lisa C., the novelist, her latest book is Shanghai Girls. Lisa, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me again.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, journalist Steve Lopez and his hit book, The Soloist, that was also made into a film. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow in Insight, we'll listen to some of our favorite interviews this year with inspiring people. Today, it's authors. One of the most talked about books of recent years was an inspirational story itself. The Soloist is the true story of a newspaper columnist, Steve Lopez, who meets a talented musician who also happens to be homeless and schizophrenic. When I spoke with Lopez in September, I asked him about his first impression upon meeting musician Nathaniel Ayers.
Well, this is a long time ago now. We're coming up on the fifth year of this adventure. Still no idea where it's headed. But I was out looking for a column in downtown Los Angeles and I heard music. Before I saw him and turned and saw what was a striking image, it's a guy playing a violin that's missing two strings, and he's standing next to a shopping cart that appears to contain all of his belongings, and on the side of it he's written with a magic marker, Little Walt Disney Concert Hall. And the music is pretty good for a guy missing half his strings, and so I asked why he played in that particular spot. It was an odd spot, and he didn't have a hat out. He wasn't playing for money, and he points and says, there's the Beethoven statue. I play here for inspiration. So I thought, okay, this is a potential column here if I can find out where this guy came from. So my first impression was this is a striking image, and there's got to be a story behind it. And then it took several weeks to get the first column, and the column turned into 10 or 20 columns, and then the book, and then the movie.
How could he play with two strings?
You know what he said? He told me that music was just about finding a note and putting it together with another one. And when he later, in this relationship, tried to give me lessons, first on violin and then on cello, and I was struggling mightily. And he would say, he repeated that to me. He said, well, you got a note there. Now, oh, that's another one. See, you got two notes. That's music. It's about finding your way. You don't know where you're headed, but you'll find your way, Mr. Lopez.
What was he playing? Was he improvising or was he playing actual pieces? And if he was playing actual pieces, he had to have four strings, didn't he?
Well, no, here's the thing. He was not playing actual pieces. And I didn't know at the time because I'm a jazz guy. And I didn't know much about classical music. He's been my tutor over these last 4.5 years. But what he was playing sounded like pieces, and he would riff off of something from, say, Beethoven's Third or Fifth. And he loved playing Beethoven because there was his muse across the street, this statue. But what he would do is just get a Beethoven idea, maybe a progression, and he would repeat that and just wander around on the two strings and, you know, pay his little tribute to Beethoven. But no, with only two strings, he couldn't play a set piece.
What did Nathaniel make of you?
He was pretty suspicious of me, you know, and that first time when I said, hey, I'd like to write about you, I'm with the LA Times. He said, why would you like to write about me? And I said, you seem like an interesting guy. But he didn't answer all of my questions. When I asked him, what's the story? How did you end up here? He would say, well, I'm just trying to get back on track. And I said, well, it sounds like you've had some training. Yeah, but that was a while ago, and I just need to get back in shape. And sometimes, too, there was not a coherent or lucid response, or a logical response, I should say. And so I realized, okay, I'm not going to get this column in 2 hours. And this led to several visits where the backstory came out in bits and pieces. And one day he was scratching names on the sidewalk, and I said, who are they? And he said, those were my classmates at Juilliard. Oh, my goodness, this guy living on Skid Row with a two-string violin went to Juilliard, so I'm running back to the office to call Juilliard and then to call the people who had been his mentors, and that's what led to the first column.
It's rather ironic that this talented classical musician was playing just downhill from the Walt Disney Concert Hall.
Yes, and he wasn't quite sure where it was. He later moved to a spot closer to Disney Hall, which is the home of the LA Philharmonic. And I said, did you come over here because of Disney Hall? And he said, well, where is it? And I said, it's right up the street. It's just up the hill here. And he said, well, I knew it was around here somewhere. And I said, well, why this spot now? It's a noisy spot near a tunnel. And he looked over at the LA Times building. And he said, well, don't you work over there? And I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, you know, New York, Cleveland, Los Angeles, I've lived a lot of places. When I look up there, I know that I'm in Los Angeles. And so he moved in part because here was a connection that he'd made, a human connection. He knew that I worked there. He knew that I came back to speak to him, you know, now and again, and he felt a little more comfortable there.
Had you had any significant personal connection with homeless people or mentally ill people before this?
I've been a journalist for, 30, 35 years, and over the years I've done my occasional story about somebody living out on the street or a family dealing with somebody who's chronically ill, and I never developed any level of expertise. I never really got into the public policy aspects of it. So no, I was a novice, and I asked myself frequently whether I had any business even maintaining this relationship, because clearly he was relying on me a little bit, and I felt like I've got no mental health training. He needs help. And so early on in this adventure, I hooked up with a downtown Los Angeles mental health agency that treats people with chronic illness. And they kind of advised me through this. And then I had sort of my on-call psychiatrist when Mr. Ayers would do something and I didn't know how to respond or what I should do next, or I got frustrated, I would call the psychiatrist and he would give me advice. So I just kind of learned as I went, and there's still a great deal to learn, and there are no easy answers. I have learned a great deal about public policy matters. I have learned through people like Daryl Steinberg here in Sacramento, that we can do much, much, much better than we've done in decades past. And in fact, when you look at the Skid Rows of California and the rest of the nation, they didn't happen by accident. Thousands of people didn't just accidentally show up one day, stark raving mad with no, you know, trying to fend for themselves. We shut down mental institutions and never followed through on the promise of the clinics that might have helped them manage their lives with dignity. And Daryl, as the godfather of Prop 63, is the guy who began to change that. I met Daryl through my stories on Mr. Ayers.
And Daryl Steinberg is mentioned in your book.
He is. He's a guy who thought it was time for California to pay penance for those sins. And Daryl was known to many of the advocates on Skid Row in Los Angeles, and he was seen as, this knight on a white horse. Finally, somebody is going to help us deal with this, and Prop 63 has made a big difference. We still have a long way to go, and the economy, the recession, some of the restraints now in government funding are making it difficult to continue that progress. But people like Daryl, he did shine a light on this and was one of the leaders in this state.
Steve Lopez, author of The Soloist. You said you met Nathaniel Ayers because you happened to be walking around downtown looking for a topic for a column. Was that a coincidence, or do you often do that? Just wander around looking for material?
Oh, you never know where the next one's coming from. And you're always, despite having done it for 35 years, you're always in a panic that you're never going to find the next one. So there's always this just little bit of dread. And you keep your eyes open and your ears open, whether you're driving in a car or walking down the street or listening to neighbors talk about something that's going on at school. Everything is a potential column. And your life is about, filtering through it all and figuring out what might work. So sometimes, yes, I just stumble upon somebody that turns out to be a column. I think more often I'm working off the news. I'm reading my own paper and talking to people who have some expertise on the themes, whatever that story might be about. You know, is it going to be about something that the governor has done or the legislature hasn't done? And then go out and, in my case, usually trying to put some people into the story, rather than, chain myself to the desk and never go out and see what the impact of these decisions might be on real lives. My column is one in which I'm usually out and about.
It started with one column and then many columns, and then you wrote a book. Did you worry at all that there might be, that Nathaniel might be taken advantage of in some way because of all the publicity that was associated with the book?
Every day, and I continue to do so. And continue to monitor him. And there were many great conflicts along the way, moral conflicts. My newspaper and many others had a policy of not using the names of people who have a mental illness. And there's some concern about whether he's competent to rationally give me the permission to use his name. So we haven't done this sort of thing in the past, and we haven't gotten personally involved in people's lives and then written about it. And so we had to decide whether that was something that we should relax our own rules and guidelines about. And that was done in conversation with my editor, with several editors, actually, with Mr. Ayers' family and with the mental health experts. And what we decided was that it would be a disservice to not do the story. The stigma surrounding mental illness exists in part because we've shoved people and the issues back off into the darkest corners. We don't want to deal with it. We don't want to even acknowledge that there are people home from wars who came home broken spiritually or mentally or physically who are wandering the streets and need help. We don't even want to acknowledge it. We want to clean this problem out of our, urban areas, and what are they doing here? Look at these bums. They made these terrible decisions with their lives. Why don't they pull themselves up by the bootstraps? So what we thought was that you can't address all of those issues with straight out public policy stories. But we had, in this case, a human face. We had a guy that readers were rooting for. They were sending strings. They were sending violins.
But so such an atypical face, though.
Atypical in the sense that, I don't know, not atypical when you compare him to other people suffering with mental illness.
But I mean in terms of his talent.
Oh, his talent, yes. But, in humanizing Nathaniel, I think the real goal was to humanize thousands like him and to simply tell people they've all got a story. They're not some stranger who made a wrong turn. They are our brothers and sisters, our sons and daughters, and they were struck down through no fault of our own, and we have abandoned them. So that was the idea, and if in the process of humanizing Nathaniel's story, we could get into all of these public policy issues, we might begin to destigmatize mental illness and put some heat on the folks at City Hall and at the Board of Supervisors and in Sacramento to address these misdeeds.
Your book was made into a film. What was it like seeing Robert Downey Jr. play you on the big screen, and how did Nathaniel react if he saw the film?
The whole thing was surreal. I mean, I couldn't believe that that those columns could be turned into a book, in part because I had no idea what the ending was, and still don't. So I kind of resisted at first suggestions that this should be turned into a book, and then was convinced that the book is really about the journey. It's about two people coming together in a chance encounter, and it's about the impact we can all have on each other's lives. And it's not just me helping him. It's the many gifts and rewards, the grace that has come my way through giving. And so that's the book. And, the ending wasn't all that important. And I think that the producers felt the same way. They made a compelling case for that. They said, no, this is a buddy story. What more do you want in a story but people who change, people who have a lasting impact on each other? And we don't know how the movie's going to end, but it's not going to end with him conducting the LA Philharmonic or playing in it, because we know that it's more complicated than that, and we're not going to sugarcoat it. We want to do a public service, and they did. So that's been very gratifying. It's quite surreal to be out with Robert Downey Jr., who's trying to get a sense of me and saying, maybe we should go through your closet or something, or your drawer, so I can get some piece of who you are. But it was very gratifying to see that they were true to their word and made the kind of movie that I think can change the way people think. I was satisfied by that. As for Nathaniel, Mr. Ayers has, as one of the symptoms of his condition, a fear of two-dimensional images. So looking at a TV screen or a movie screen to him is terrifying. It's like watching ghosts. But he has been to the movie. And you would say that I think it's fair to say he likes the soundtrack better than the movie. He loves the music. But, the whole process has been helpful to him, I would like to think. Maybe it's just rationalization. But one thing that Mr. Ayers lacked was insight into his own condition. It's difficult to accept and appreciate the depth of your illness when you've been so ostracized. And so many people with a mental illness end up ashamed, thinking that, they're undeserving of our attention. And you need to develop a full awareness of the depth of the condition before you can address it. And the book and the movie and the columns and the relationship have brought Mr. Ayers in front of the mirror. And he has at times had great difficulty with it, and he has many other times thanked me for leading him to something that he felt that he had to do. And I think he feels the same way about the movie. He now signs autographs, the soloist. And from one day to the next, I'm not sure how he's handling all of this attention, but so far it looks like he's doing pretty well.
Steve Lopez, author of The Soloist, columnist at the Los Angeles Times. Steve Lopez, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, poet Rita Dove and her book Sonata Mulattica, about the friendship between Beethoven and a black pianist. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We're listening to some of our favorite author interviews of 2009. The great poet Rita Dove, Pulitzer Prize winner, former poet laureate, had a new book this year, Sonata Mulattica, a collection of poems telling a surprising tale from musical history. When Rita Dove joined us in May, I asked her to explain the book's title.
Sonata Mulattica means, basically, if we translated it, mulatto sonata. But it comes from a dedication that Beethoven wrote in his sonata that we know of as the Kreutzer Sonata, the original violinist. The violinist who premiered the piece was a mulatto by the name of George Bridgetower. And in his dedication to the sonata, to this violinist, he calls him his mulatto Bridgetower. So I simply took that as the title of the book.
Now, this book is more than a collection of poems. How did you envision this book and describe it for us?
Well, the book is actually a series of linked poems which chronicle the life of George Bridgetower, who was a real prodigy on the violin, and his claim to fame is that he did meet Beethoven. Beethoven wrote the sonata for him, and he premiered the piece. And then, because of a chance remark, he calls it a saucy remark that he made to a girl that Beethoven took offense with, Beethoven withdrew the dedication and renamed the sonata for another violinist, Kreutzer. So the book basically it's a group of poems from various points of view. There are poems that are spoken by Haydn and poems that are spoken by Beethoven and, of course, Bridgetower and the Prince of Wales, all sorts of people, which piece together a portrait of the musical life at that time and the kind of intricacies of fame and hobnobbing and class wars that went on at the turn of the century, 18th and 19th century. So that's basically what the book is about. It's different than a novel in the sense that you get this kaleidoscopic piecing together from various viewpoints, and it's different from an ordinary book of poems in that it reads a little like a detective novel.
Why did you think it was important to tell the story of this man who's largely forgotten?
I thought it was important because I think there are many of these kind of cases in the world where someone could have made it into the history books and did not for whatever reasons. And the kind of the vagrancies of fame and how things kind of glance off of that magic moment, it's what fascinated me. I do think there's an underside to history that is in fact what most of us are familiar with. We go through life, we don't think in large, grand historical terms. And I'm always fascinated by what happens underneath the radar, so to speak. When I ran across this man's story and I realized that, my gosh, I didn't realize that there were black people basically gallivanting around Europe, you know, in the 18th and 19th century, and in fact were in royal houses. And so that whole part of society that I had no idea of, I was really fascinated with. That started me on the book. And as I got into it and began to realize how little we knew about this man's life and yet how rich that life was, how rich all of his connections and the things that he experienced, I just thought that it would be really interesting to look at this historical moment, I guess you could say, through a poetic lens. And my goal was really to have people feel not that this was a piece of classical music arcana that they could say, oh, you know, I can't touch that because it's so far away. You know, it's not a marble bust on a piano. It is more like slipping into their skins and saying, gosh, I can understand how they reacted. And in that sense, connect this more closely to all of humanity.
My guest is Rita Dove, the poet. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner and a former U.S. poet laureate. And her latest book is called Sonata Mulattica. I was listening to you reading from one of the poems from that book on the website, Poems Out Loud. And this was the poem called Ludwig van Beethoven's Return to Vienna. We'll listen to the second half of that poem, but could you first explain the context for this poem, what inspired it specifically?
Mm. In this poem, Ludwig van Beethoven is contemplating returning to Vienna. It's the turn of the century, it's 1802, and he has gone into the country basically to try to cure his encroaching deafness. They didn't know what caused it, and of course that's a devastating thing for a composer. And in this poem, so he is out in the country trying to get cured, but realizing that he has to keep writing and composing no matter what. And this poem takes place right before, in fact, he comes back to Vienna and meets this violinist. They have a Bridgetower. They have an instant connection. From all reports, it really enlivened him again. So we have him now right before he's about to meet someone who will get him really composing and in the scene again.
Well, we'll pick it up from there. Here's Rita Dove reading from her poem Ludwig van Beethoven's Return to Vienna.
At first I raged. Then music raged in me, rising so swiftly I could not write quickly enough to ease the roiling. I would stop to light a lamp, and whatever I'd missed, larks flying to nest, church bells, the shepherd's home toward evening song, rushed in, and I would rage again. I am by nature a conflagration. I would rather leap than sit and be looked at. So when my proud city spread her gypsy skirts, I re-entered, burning towards her greater constant light. Call me rough, ill-tempered, slovenly. I tell you, every tenderness I have ever known has been nothing but thwarted violence, an ache so permanent and deep the lightest touch awakens it. It is impossible to care enough. I have returned with a second symphony and 15 piano variations, which I've named Prometheus, after the rogue Titan, the half a god who knew the worst sin is to take what cannot be given back. I smile and bow, and the world is loud. And though I dare not lean in to shout, can't you see that I'm deaf? I also cannot stop listening.
I really feel taken into the mind of Beethoven. How did you set about writing that poem?
Well, you know, what I did was I read Beethoven's own words. He has this incredible letter that he wrote to his brother called the Heiligenstadt Testament. And in it, he writes it from this little village that he is in, Heiligenstadt. It's the first time he mentions his deafness, and it's such a moving and quiet and vulnerable letter in which he talks about the things he's trying to do with his life. And when I read that letter, I felt him talking. I heard him talking. And after that, that's how I got into that poem. I was daunted before reading that letter at the prospect of presuming to write in Beethoven's voice. And then I thought, you know, we presume as writers all the time to take on people's voices, and the only thing that we must do is try to be honest and try to make sure that it's not our voice, but to make sure that it does approximate what we imagine they would be like. So after reading his letter and thinking about that task, I guess you'd say the burden of the writer, I just dove in.
Rita, I enjoyed watching on your website. There is a collection of videos of you performing various ballroom dances, some with your husband, including a tango, a samba, and a rumba, and you choreographed or co-choreographed them. How did you get into ballroom dancing, and how did you get so good?
Oh, my gosh, well, thank you. We don't feel nearly as good as we'd like to be. Actually, ballroom dancing came about as a result of a small tragedy. We had our house burned down in about 10 years ago, almost 11. Lightning struck it. Seems very dramatic, but from 1 minute to the next, the house had burned down, and our neighbors, who were wonderful with helping us collect things and sift through the ashes and stuff like that, came to us after about a week of this and with tickets to a dinner dance, and they wanted to distract us, and they said, go out and buy something beautiful. We're going to a dance. And we had no clothes, but we went out and bought the first clothes we bought were kind of, you know, gorgeous clothes. And then we went out to a dance, and there were people there actually doing ballroom dancing. And I said wistfully, I always wanted to learn to do that. And one of our neighbors said, well, then why don't we all do it together? And she arranged for the whole neighborhood to take lessons. We were the only ones who really stuck with it. So it's that small gift that came out of that tragedy. So we've been doing it now for, 10 years, I think.
And do you watch Dancing with the Stars? And have you ever thought that you might be a good star for that as a former poet laureate?
Oh, gosh. We do watch Dancing with the Stars whenever we get a chance. We kind of watch it with the eye of someone saying, oh, look at that, no heel lead. And we're sitting there critiquing the dances as they go along. I think it's a great thing. And I would love to do it, but I'm also sure that I'm not eligible because I know too much about ballroom dancing. Because what they would like to do is get someone who has no experience in ballroom dancing. So I'm off that hook.
Rita Dove, the poet, is a Pulitzer Prize winner, a former U.S. Poet Laureate, and her latest book, just published, is called Sonata Mulattica. Rita Dove, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. On the next Insight, some of our most inspirational stories from 2009. Guests include Zoe Dunning, the retired Navy commander who came out as a lesbian but won her discharge case and was able to continue serving. Also, two women, one black, one white, who fought for civil rights in Mississippi. Other moving stories, too. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.